If you enjoy the Tudor Chess podcast, then perhaps you would consider becoming an official subscriber of the channel. From as little as £5 a month, official subscribers get access to a weekly bonus episode and additional content via Patreon. Just head to patreon.com/thetudorchest or search for the podcast in Apple Podcasts. Dr. Joanne Paul is a historian, author, broadcaster, and former lecturer at Sussex University. She joins me today for a fascinating and at times amusing discussion all about the House of Dudley, the famous family for whom the Tower of London and the execution scaffold would loom large. From the hated Edmund Dudley, Henry VII's chief financial enforcer, to John Dudley, Duke of Northumberland, known to history as the key villain in the saga which placed Lady Jane Grey temporarily on the throne of England, to the charismatic great love of Queen Elizabeth I's life, Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester. This was a family who came from very humble stock, but who would rise to the very top of the Tudor nobility, witnessing up close all of the drama associated with this most infamous of royal dynasties. Welcome back to the Tudor Chess Podcast, episode 30, The House of Dudley with Dr. Joanne Paul. Welcome to the Tudor Chess Podcast, Dr. Joanne Paul. It's a real thrill to have you come onto the show. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
Before we get into the meat of the conversation today, which is about the House of Dudley and the phenomenal book that you wrote about this iconic family, just a few questions just to get to know you a bit better. So can you provide us with a bit of an intro into your background, where you grew up and what you do full time?
Sure. I was born in Canada. I am Canadian.
I think she's Canadian. I didn't want to. Yeah. I mean, I knew North American, but I was like, I'm fairly certain that's a Canadian accent, not an American one.
Well done. You're doing well so far. I was born in Toronto and did my first 2 degrees in history and politics in Canada, and then did my PhD over here in the UK at Queen Mary University of London. And I'm now on the southeast coast, the Sussex coast, which is really lovely. I spent many years in academia, higher education, and currently I'm an honorary senior lecturer at the University of Sussex, but I'm not teaching full-time anymore. I've sort of jumped ship and trying out the waters as a freelancer. So I'm writing full time, which is kind of the dream. It's what I wanted to do when I was very young, and it took me a little while to kind of come back round to it. But I am really, really loving it.
What sparked your passion for the Tudor period? So was there something that sparked that?
Funnily enough, I think it was creative writing. I and reading. My mum read to me a lot when I was very young, Chronicles of Narnia, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Anne of Green Gables, Little Women, all of which actually are historical books in some ways. And I think that really, it was fiction that really sparked my interest in history. And then from then I went to sort of more creative nonfiction and then properly the study of history. As a young person, it was all sorts of history. I was very into Egyptology for a while. I think I still know the hieroglyphic alphabet. It was just the sort of this otherworldly past that fascinated me. But as I went further in my education, and especially at university, it was the 16th century that always fascinated me. There's something about that period where it's this real transition from the medieval to the modern. There are things that are recognizably modern and you can see how they'll develop into the things that we have today. But then there are things that are also completely foreign to us and have that air of sort of chivalric romance about them. And I think it's that combination that I find really interesting. And from a sort of more intellectual perspective, this question of the paths not taken, because it's this transitional period, it could have gone a completely different way. And that I find really interesting.
If you could, and this is a difficult question to ask any historian, but if you could pick a single moment from history to go back and witness, do you have one that immediately springs to mind?
Probably not a particular sort of event or moment, but I'm deeply interested in the sort of late 1520s, early 1530s, that sort of break with Rome period. It was also the Renaissance was really making itself known in England at the time. You know, I work quite a bit on figures from that period. I've written on Thomas More, for instance. And just to see all of that play out, I think would be, it would inform a lot of the questions that I've always had. And if I could keep my head through it, I think I could learn a lot.
Yeah. Oh, no, this is pure, you get to time travel, you're there for a day, you get to jump back into the 21st century. So
yeah,
you'll absolutely
somewhere in there, pick a day in there and maybe somewhere around 1532 would be great.
Yeah, I think it'd be fascinating as well to see that moment when Chapuis was forced to show some measure of deference to Anne Boleyn. That I think would be fascinating to see just everyone in the room and what they, you know, did everyone notice? What were they thinking? I think that would be an amazing thing to see.
Yeah, I have another one related to Chapuis, but you're going to have me come back on because it's related to my next book project and I'm not allowed to talk about it yet. So I will save that one and you'll have to have me back.
Absolutely. So is there a Tudor misconception that you would love to change?
Well, I think we're going to talk about the Dudleys and the sort of the black legend of the Dudleys. Obviously, there are some elements of that that I would love to see changed. I got to know John Dudley, Duke of Northumberland, very well, and I think that there are some key misconceptions around him. But I think we'll come to that. If I had to pick the sort of the one that irks me day to day the most, it would be the presentation of Jane Seymour as sort of this pure innocent. When I really don't think she was, I think, you know, Anne Boleyn is presented as the seductress, but, you know, they courted for years and years and years, whereas Jane Seymour comes in, she does essentially what Anne Boleyn already did, while Anne Boleyn is in danger of her life and everything else. And I think she knew what she was about and is far more ambitious and perhaps a little calculating than she's usually presented. Yeah. I'd be interested in countering that one.
So you very elegantly mentioned there that we are here to talk about the House of Dudley, and the basis of the conversation is very much around the book that you wrote, The House of Dudley. So what inspired you to write a book about this particular family? I mean, they're a known commodity in the Tudor story, but I suppose they're not the sort of people that we talk about all the time. Was that part of the draw, I suppose, to writing about this quite controversial and very important family?
Yeah, I think you're right. They don't tend to take center stage very often. Robert, maybe occasionally, next to Elizabeth. Edmund and John are barely ever represented on screen, for instance. We just don't really hear from them. For me, it started where the book starts, actually, with Leicester's Commonwealth, which is this pamphlet that circulates the Elizabethan court in the 1580s and lists all the scandals and rumors associated with the Dudley family over three generations, accuses them of raising their children to be traitors and to attempt to take over the throne. And I mean, it accuses Robert Dudley of trying to kill someone with a salad, of using an Italian ointment to enhance his member, various things. And obviously not all of it can be true, but of course some of it is. They did over three generations rise very high and fall very hard. And I just remember looking at it and thinking, I mean, what is going on with this family, right? This can't be right, but what is the culture of a family? Every family has a culture. What is the culture of a family that produces this? What was it like to be a member of this family? And so I really set out to tell the story of a family. Edmund John and Robert end up being the kind of key characters that people are familiar with, but my intention very much was to zoom out from them. In particular, I talk about the women of the family as much as I am able to, sort of jump from point of view and the figures in the family to try to give a more comprehensive sort of holistic presentation of their story. I think it was curiosity, really. What happens in a family so that in every generation over the Tudor period, someone gets in touching distance of the throne and then is executed for treason?
Yeah, because I mean, there are three. It was also three generations of men who were beheaded, wasn't it? Because you had Edmund, then you had John, then you had Guildford.
Yeah.
So it was a family who, for whom, the Tower of London loomed very large across, you know, huge swathes of their life.
Yeah, there were very few members of the Dudley family who didn't end up in the Tower, imprisoned in the Tower at some point. Like, I'm having trouble coming up with many of them. And not just accused, but convicted of treason. Robert Dudley is convicted of treason before he goes on to have this career in the court of Elizabeth I. So, yeah, I just wanted to know what that family was like beyond the sort of black legend and the way in which we've been told to think about them. I wanted to get back to their actual letters, their actual experiences.
Yes, I've actually had a very similar sort of experience with the book that I've written. So my first book comes out in July, and it's about the rise and fall of the Pole family.
Ah, congratulations.
And
I can see similarities already. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because, again, we know Margaret Pole, we know Reginald, but really that's kind of it.
Yeah.
But there are huge similarities. We're talking about a family that, again, it was only Ursula Pole that was never imprisoned. So very, very similar experience, I think, to what you've said.
Oh, that'll be a fantastic book. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you. I'm really excited. It's coming out at the end of July.
Make sure I get a copy, please. Yeah.
You'll get a copy. You'll get a signed copy. Don't worry.
Yes.
So to start with Edmund Dudley, the first sort of key member of the Dudley family, he rises to a position of considerable power during the reign of Henry VII as a sort of a key financial administrator. So how did he come to that position? Because the Dudleys weren't, to the best of my knowledge, I mean, they became very ennobled later, but at this point, they were not members of the sort of the high nobility.
Not at all. Not this strain of the Dudley family, anyway. There are the Barons Dudley, which is sort of the elder line. Edmund is descended. He's the eldest son of a younger son of a baron. So he's a country gentleman at best, essentially. Yeah. He's a trained lawyer. By all accounts, a pretty good one, but sort of academic. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I do have niche interests. but he particularly knew these very archaic King's Prerogative laws that shouldn't have made him very important. But Henry VII at the time was feeling very precarious as the founder of a dynasty that might end with him. His eldest son had died, his queen had died. He had only one young son, also named Henry. And there had been decades and decades of warfare, civil warfare, and there was nothing that suggested that it wouldn't go back to that, really. And so he wanted to shore up his power. And one of the ways he did that was by collecting as much coin as possible. And more than that, collecting obligations, making people in debt to him, tying them up in these financial transactions that meant he sort of owned them in some sense, that they owed him something and he could control them that way. And it just so happened that Edmund Dudley was someone who knew how to do that very effectively because he had all this knowledge of the king's prerogative and these laws that could kind of be dusted off and redeployed. How exactly he came to Henry VII's attention, we don't know for sure. Almost certainly, though, it had to do with Henry VII's devoted minister, Reginald Bray, who died shortly before we know that Edmund entered the king's service. Reginald Bray seems to have had some relationship with Edmund's father, and so probably knew of him. So we can imagine that Reginald Bray, as he's dying, he wants to ensure that his work and the king's work continues, and so suggests that Edmund Dudley might be the man who can help Henry VII. And he very much was. Very, very quickly, he sidesteps a promotion. He actually has to pay to get out of a promotion that would continue him on his legal path. Instead, he becomes Speaker of the House of Commons and very soon after is sworn into the Council of the King and starts his work collecting money on behalf of the King.
So the Edmund Dudley you're describing sounds like a complete forerunner of Thomas Cromwell in many respects.
In some ways, that's true. I mean, Henry VII set the groundwork very much for people like Cromwell and Wolsey in his son's reign. There's this fantastic book by Stephen Gunn called Henry VII's New Men. And it talks about this very deliberate strategy on the part of Henry VII to pluck men out of obscurity, essentially, who were from nothing, but were very well educated, fantastic administrators, great bureaucrats, and place them in positions that would have otherwise probably gone to nobility. And this did a couple of things for Henry VII. It meant that he had competent administrators, which the nobility were not. they were not that good at it. It also meant that he had men who were disposable. He could lift them up and they owed him everything, and he could tear them down and there were few consequences to doing so. It wasn't, you know, like executing a duke, for instance. And thirdly, it gave the nobility someone else to hate other than him, by fostering this discontent between these elevated, almost nouveau riche sort of administrators, the new men, and the ancient nobility. He could sit above it all and just let them fight it out. So it was a brilliant stratagem. And yeah, we see Henry VIII doing very similar things with people like Wolsey and Cromwell and others. I don't think that Edmund Dudley had anything like the administrative acumen of someone like Thomas Cromwell. He was brilliant at it. But in terms of this sort of career path and this elevation, certainly it's similar. It's also in some ways similar to the path of Thomas More. Both of them did 2 years at Oxford and then left early, not finishing their degree, in order to study the law. And then fairly soonish after sort of establishing a legal reputation, ended up in the service of the king. And of course, for both of them, it ends very badly. So I think we do miss the precursors to those men whose names that we tend to know in Henry VIII's reign if we don't look at those of Henry VII.
You mentioned there that, you know, it was a good way of Henry VII having somebody that the nobility could hate, but Edmund Dudley was also very disliked by the common people, to the best of my knowledge. And one of the first acts that Henry VIII does when he becomes king is to order Edmund's execution. So what was it that turned Edmund Dudley into such a figure of loathing for the sort of the common people of England?
It was that he was very good at his job, essentially, that he executed the king's will. Sorry, that he executed the king's will so effectively in collecting the coin. He used men of very dubious reputations to essentially browbeat people and to sway juries, often with threats and all sorts. And he ruined people's lives, essentially, in trying to extract coin from them. I tell a story in the book about a haberdasher named Thomas Sunnith, who Edmund Dudley just hounds and hounds and hounds over the course of several years. They both actually end up in the Tower at the same time, Sunnith by Dudley's hand. And that is just the one story we know of. We have Edmund Dudley's account books. He single-handedly in under 4 years raises the income of the crown by over half. And there are just names and names and names of people from whom he's extracted coin. And each one of those, there's probably a story much like that of Thomas Sunnith, of people being beaten down, sometimes literally, by the agents of Edmund Dudley, and Edmund Dudley acting very coldly towards them each time. He is very much someone who doesn't bother making friends, who isn't that concerned about his popularity. He seems to have this sort of black and white view of things, that it's the king's will. He is an agent of the king's will. Therefore, it has to happen. And any pleas against that are just an irrelevance and almost an insult to him. He seems to have this bit of a chip on his shoulder about his sort of his proximity to the king and the power that gives him. So, yeah, without question, very, very quickly, he becomes very unpopular. In particularly London, but it spreads beyond that as well. And that in many ways leads to his downfall, because as you say, Henry VIII, when he comes to the throne, he lets Dudley's enemies arrest him immediately. Edmund does spend just over a year in the Tower before the order for his execution is given. But we think it's probably because Henry VIII goes on progress and really starts to understand how deeply unpopular Edmund Dudley is, that he gives the order, he sends the order back for his execution. So it is probably that vitriol, really, that is spread around about Edmund Dudley that is his ultimate undoing.
So he's eventually beheaded, and with his execution, there's obviously an attainder. His son, John Dudley, is very young at this age. At this time, I think he was about 7 or 8 when his father was executed, but he eventually grew to be a sort of consummate courtier. So he was very skilled in many of the activities that Henry VIII greatly favoured, like the tournament, the tourney, archery and so on. How did he go from being, the son of a man executed and hated to being in the household of Henry VIII?
This is where we have to look at the women of the Dudley family, because in each case, each generation where there's these tragic falls, it's the women who often rebuild the family. This is very much the case when it comes to Edmund's fall and John's rise. His mother, a woman named Elizabeth Grey, was from a much more noble family than the Dudleys. She was a sort of distant relation of Elizabeth Woodville, who of course becomes Edward IV's queen. And so I think she knew how to play court politics much, much better than Edmund did. And within just over a year of Edmund Dudley's execution. And again, attainder for treason. You know, it's not just his death. It's a huge scandal. She manages to marry the illegitimate uncle of the king, Arthur Plantagenet, who had helped to raise Henry VIII, who remained at this point a close friend to Henry VIII, and she marries him. And I think it's that that allows the family, her children, back into the king's good graces. So John is restored in blood. The stain of his father's treason is legally, at least, removed from him. And he's placed in the household of Edward Guildford, who is at this point the master of the king's armory. And he gives John that education in arms that serves him so well in the court of Henry VIII. And so as a young man, he goes to war in France and is knighted. He returns and with various of his friends, young men like himself, is throwing some of these tournaments as well as participating in them. And yeah, Henry VIII loves it.
So he, by 1525, he marries Jane Guildford. And over the course of their marriage, they have a whopping 13 children, 8 of whom are boys, which would have been the stuff of dreams for Henry VIII. So what was John Dudley like as a husband and father? I think one of the things that is often viewed is that he's a very harsh man, that, you know, not particularly loving. But I believe that his relationship with his wife was actually incredibly strong, and they had a good marriage.
Best we can tell, that's absolutely the case. I mean, you mentioned the 13 children. You tend to stop after 2 or 3 if the marriage is not something you're both into. They have far more children than is necessary, strictly speaking. Though, of course, tragically, most don't make it past the age of 25. And there's no hint ever of any kind of rumor or suggestion that there isn't anything but a loving, faithful relationship between the two of them. I mean, you think about John Dudley and all the things that are said about him. At no point does anyone suggest that they don't have a very loyal marriage. I think at one point there's some suggestion that he's going to cast off his wife to marry Elizabeth or something like that. But there's never really any suggestion. We have some of their letters which indicate this. There's a letter that they write together to their son, also named John. And there's this sort of John's writing it, and then there's this sort of sense in which he passes it off to Jane, like, okay, now talk to your mother. And she writes a little note in it as well. And when John, you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but when John himself is executed, or just before he's executed, Jane refers to him as the most best gentleman ever living woman was matched withal. And she's sick, physically sick to her stomach with the anxiety of what might happen to him as well as to her children. So there seems to be a truly loving relationship between them. In her will, she's gifting things that belong to John. And I go on too long, but I think their relationship is a really beautiful one, as well as being politically powerful. They're this great Tudor power couple.
Yeah, and a rarity, I think, for the time, for there to be, you know, for there to not be rumours, for there to, the best of my knowledge, no sort of illegitimate children hanging around as well. Nope. This is really rare for the time.
Yeah, and it's worth remembering too, as I said, he grew up in the house of Edward Guildford, who was Jane Guildford's father. So they had known each other as children. They'd grown up together, and it is it would have been an expectation, at least an aim, for John Edmund Guildford's ward to marry his daughter and sort of keep everything together in the family. And so they probably grew up knowing that was to be what was intended for them. But also, I think it speaks to the fact that they had this connection as very, very young people, a friendship. I suspect there was a friendship and a sense of alliance between them. And as you say, that is really rare for this time to see that so clearly.
Where did the family sit when it came to their religious beliefs? I think because of what later happens with Jane Grey and the desire to not allow the Catholic Mary to ascend the throne, that we therefore assume that the whole of the Dudley family were very sort of lent very much towards the Protestant faith. Was that the case?
I think, yes. I mean, at least it's very difficult, of course, to know people's personal beliefs unless they declare them. And even then, it can be hard. What we can trace are their political allegiances. And certainly the Dudleys, during the tumultuous break with Rome, those decades, are allying themselves with people like Anne Boleyn and Thomas Cromwell and the Seymours, and these forces for reform, for religious reform within the English court. And as time goes on, that becomes even more apparent. And we can also look at who their enemies were, and their enemies were the Howards, who, of course, were religiously conservative. The Dudleys do very, very well under Queens Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Parr, not so well under Catherine Howard, for instance. So it very much appears that they are aligning themselves with that reformist movement at court, action, if you like. And later on, John Dudley will respond to accusations that he's a religious instrumentalist, that his religion ebbs and flows with politics, and to say that no, he's always been what we would now call a Protestant. I will say, though, that that doesn't mean that they don't ally themselves with Catholic forces at court. And in particular, one of the things I was really interested in my research is how closely allied they were with the Lady Mary, Mary Tudor. She's godmother to several Dudley children. There are gifts exchanged between them. There are moments where John is sort of sent to transport her from place to place as a friendly force. And considering what happens sort of down the line, I thought that that was very interesting. And also speaks to the fact that, yeah, I mean, factions is probably too strong a word, that it wasn't black or white in that way.
So by the time that Henry VIII eventually dies, John Dudley is a central part of the Regency Council that's appointed to govern England during the minority rule of Edward VI. So what roles had John Dudley performed sort of in the later years of Henry VIII's reign that got him to this position where he was viewed as a central part of the next reign's a central part of the council that would oversee the next reign, essentially?
It had a lot to do with the military training that we were talking about. He becomes known, I suppose, as a sort of safe pair of hands when it comes to anything in terms of war or defense of the realm or the like. It also tends to flow from his connection to Edward Seymour. They've been friends for a long time. They seem to have met as young men in France when they were both knighted, and then participated in various tournaments together, various property transactions, and so on. And Edward Seymour is uncle to the heir to the throne, who becomes Edward VI. And so he is always one step above Dudley in the chain, as he ought to be, really, with that sort of connection to the to the crown. But every time he vacates a post, it tends to go to John Dudley. And we have some letters, at least, where Edward Seymour is recommending John Dudley for the post he's vacating. One of the most important of these is Lord Admiral. John, in many ways, revolutionizes the English Navy in the few short years that he's Lord Admiral. Speaking again of these changes to Tudor bureaucracy in these years, it had previously been the case that the position of Lord Admiral went to nobles as a sort of reward. For instance, the illegitimate son of Henry VIII is Lord Admiral for a period in the 1520s when I think he's about 6 years old. so he's,
Yeah, I was going to say he was really young at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah, he wasn't doing much with it. Whereas when John Dudley takes on the role, we see all sorts of administrative reforms that really set England on the path to be the global superpower that we know it to be centuries later. And so in these sorts of roles, John really proves himself as someone competent, faithful, loyal. And there's this sort of no-nonsense about him. We also know from later reports that he had a real presence about him, a sort of authority and maybe even a bit of a threatening one. And so I think those connections, that history, that military prowess, all of that prepares him for a very important position, as you say, in the court of Edward VI.
So when Edward VI takes the throne and the Regency Council is set up, he's actually elevated to the peerage. He's made an earl. Was this quite sort of planned in advance, or was it a way of, again, sort of solidifying the men's positions as senior members of the nobility?
He actually had already been a member of the peerage previously, because he was Viscount Lisle, which is a title that he inherits through his mother's line. It was his stepfather, Arthur Plantagenet, who had been Viscount Lisle, thanks to the marriage to John's mother. But he had fallen out of favor with the king, been imprisoned for a time, and then shortly, not long before Henry VIII died, he was forgiven and was so relieved at having been forgiven that he dropped dead, which John Dudley doesn't seem to mind that. They hadn't gotten on for years and years at that point, and it meant that John became Viscount Lisle. So he was already sort of on the ladder, but the idea that he would rise any higher than that really only came about because of Edward Seymour's place in this Regency Council, and then above that as Lord Protector. There's no evidence that there was a sort of set plan or agreement, but certainly it was in Seymour, who became Duke of Somerset's, it was in his best interest to ensure that his allies were well rewarded, and John Dudley was one of his closest allies in the court and the council.
So you've mentioned Edward Seymour a couple of times, and the fact that the two men were good friends, and you know that Edward Seymour would have been responsible for John Dudley's rise from a viscountcy into an earldom, but their relationship does eventually break down quite considerably. So what led to the breakdown of their relationship, and how did John Dudley actually end up triumphing over Edward Seymour?
Yeah, I had no idea when I started mapping out this book how far back their relationship went and how many decades of camaraderie there was between these two men. And a camaraderie, it's a brotherhood. They treat each other as brothers, I think, for many, many years. And so when that relationship does break down, it's a real tragedy. And we can see this in some of the frustrated letters that John Dudley sends around the time of Seymour's fall, really almost angry at him for continuing the actions, the behaviors that had led to his downfall. So Seymour makes himself Lord Protector, essentially, and is king in all but name, but then doesn't rule very well. He fails to take the advice of the council and to consult them properly. He mismanages the finances, various policies. It leads to a rebellion, which John Dudley, as sort of the realm's go-to commander, has to put down. And so John participates in a sort of coup to overthrow Seymour, but he refuses to have him executed. And there's this great scene that we get where the council is considering having Seymour put to death, and John, with his hand on the hilt of his sword, says, "He that would have his blood would have mine also." And that sort of ends the discussion. At least any official discussion of the execution of Seymour. But Seymour keeps pushing, keeps trying. He's let back into the council, but John is just so frustrated that he seems to want to get back to his position of rule. John says in a letter at one point, what thinks my Lord Somerset in this way, when his late governance is so misliked still, when people are still so angry at him, why is he pushing his luck in this way? And so eventually Seymour is arrested and convicted and charged with various treasons and felonies. He's not convicted of any treason. He is convicted of felonies, however, for which the punishment is death, including compassing or planning the death of John Dudley. And when presented with his charge, Edmund said that he hadn't decided that he was going to try to kill his friend John Dudley, but he had considered it. So it's clear that there was probably a plot against John from Seymour. And so Seymour is put to death, and John really becomes the leading man in the realm.
So, when Edward VI becomes gravely ill, he famously creates a new line of succession. His device for the succession, as the documents known, which names Lady Jane Grey, John Dudley's daughter-in-law, as his nominated heir. Now, history tells us time and again that John Dudley was almost like the sort of the Grim Reaper hanging over Edward, pulling the strings and effectively forcing Edward's hand. What are your feelings on this?
I love that image. I think you painted that very well. I think that very much is the image that we are often presented with. I think it's worth tweaking it slightly and remembering that Edward is essentially a young man at this point. He's not an 8, 9-year-old at this point. He's a teenager. He very much knows his own mind. If anyone feels like getting into Edward VI's mind, I wouldn't recommend it, but he does keep a journal during his reign, and he is definitely sure of himself. As read letters to his sister Mary as well. He is not someone easily cowed. So the idea that this young sick boy is being manipulated by the evil Duke doesn't quite hold up. We also don't know the timings of things. We know that Jane Grey becomes Jane Dudley by marrying Guildford Dudley, John's son, in May of that year. The device for the succession may have already been written in some form before that. We don't know. So the sequence of events is difficult to determine. The other thing that I'd say is that from Edward's point of view, the device was a really good idea, because he does skip over essentially three people in giving the crown to Jane. And those people are his elder half-sister Mary, who's Catholic. So she gotta go. His still elder, but the younger of the two, half sister Elizabeth, who Edward would be pretty confident is Protestant. So there's questions about why he skips over her, and then he skips over Jane's mother, Frances, who's definitely Protestant as well. And I think what is often lost in telling this story is, yes, their religion is part of the motivation for this, but what he's looking for is a man. He's looking for a male heir, and none of those women were likely to produce a male heir. Mary and Elizabeth weren't married, so and it would be difficult to negotiate their marriages in a hurry. And Frances was almost certainly past any childbearing years, had had three daughters, and hadn't given birth in 10 years. Jane was married or about to be married, a young woman, could already be pregnant with a son. And so I think Edward is trying to find the fastest route to a Dudley, to an heir. Now, that heir might have been a Dudley heir. And that's where John may have had something to do with at least the planning around that all-important marriage. But the device made sense to Edward.
I think Edward is also a character that we were discussing earlier about Tudor misconceptions, and I think as a whole, Edward is a there is a just huge misconceptions about him. And I've said before that I think that he showed all the signs of growing up to be even more of a tyrant than his father would have than his father was.
He's for all you Game of Thrones people out there, he's a bit of a Joffrey.
Joffrey, yeah.
I actually and I think unfortunately it was cancelled after only one season, but the Becoming Elizabeth TV series, I think that they were doing a good job of setting that up in Edward. That he would turn on people very quickly, and that he saw himself as chosen by God, as a new Josiah, as this figure who would bring about the religious redemption of the country, and was an absolute zealot about it. So I 100% agree. And by the time he's dying, again, he's not a child anymore. He's very much a young man and had started picking up the reins of power already, and was chomping at the bit to do even more.
I loved Becoming Elizabeth. I was really disappointed when it wasn't renewed for a second season. I thought it was so good. Although I do think it should have been called Becoming Mary, because I thought that the
Yes, oh, she was
oh, I mean,
amazing.
finally, a portrayal of Mary that does
Yeah.
her justice, and that wasn't a one-note sort of
Yeah.
caricature. I just thought that Romola Gari was she stole the show. I mean, every time she was on screen, I was just glued. I thought she was incredible.
Well, and there was a John Dudley, who I think was presented fantastically, a military presence, charismatic, this ally relationship with Edward Seymour. And he too, he wasn't a caricature, it would be interesting to see where they took him, but he was endearing. And I think that speaks more to what John Dudley was like, at least at the beginning of the reign.
He's definitely viewed as a bit of a villain, which I think is in part created by fiction and films like Lady Jane from 1986, for example. Having spent so much time in his company, what do you actually think of him?
It's difficult, because, as you say, you spend so much time with someone. He was the first person in writing this book where I'd really gone from their birth straight through to their death, and was able to follow him very, very closely throughout his life. And so it's hard not to become sort of attached. And I don't mind admitting that I cried when I wrote his death, in the House of Dudley. That being said, I try not to fall into, you could call it a trap or whatever, of becoming too attached and having sort of favorites and defending them to the death and all of that sort of thing. I think that can be dangerous to the historical project. That all being said, and with some attempt at objectivity and an admission of my own subjectivity, I think he certainly wasn't what he's painted to be. He was probably ambitious. God knows they all were. I think more than anything, he wanted to protect his family and his family name. I think he ended up on this sort of hamster wheel, where the higher he went up, the further the fall, and the only protection was to keep going higher and higher and higher. And he made a lot of mistakes, but most of those mistakes actually came from a place of mercy. His greatest pitfall, we talked about Edmund Dudley and his sort of his fatal flaw being his unpopularity and his disinterest in doing anything to make friends. John Dudley has a very different one. He tended too much, I think, to forgive people. He would fine people up the wazoo and then release them to seek their revenge on him, essentially. And you see that, for instance, with Fitzalan, Earl of Arundel, who really plays a pivotal role in bringing John Dudley down. You see him do it with Seymour too, right? He tries to have him rehabilitated, and then Seymour plots to kill him. So actually, it's his mercy, in some ways, that becomes a problem for him. There's some great letters that I was able to work with, where not long before it all goes down in the succession crisis, 1553, where he's really weighing up the price of serving the king and whether he'd rather just retire to the country. And he is in the country at the time. He's ill or feigning illness. And he decides in the end to go back to court and to serve. And I think part of it is performance, of course, although he's writing to a sort of lesser person at the time. But I think there is this sense of service in John. I think he is trying to serve the crown. Edward VI says it's Jane, it's Jane. Happens to be his daughter-in-law, all the better. And then, when he's accused then of treason, he says, "Well, I was serving the queen. The queen was Jane. I was doing what I was told by the people who are judging him at that time." So he ends up, I think very much a victim. And I might get some emails for saying
No, but I think it's very similar, I suppose. It's almost like Occam's theory of, that
that.
the simplest explanation is often the right one. And with this, I mean, I was talking to somebody a little while ago about Jane Boleyn by Countess Rochford, and we were saying, what on earth led her to do what she did with Catherine Howard? And I said, well, she was doing what she was told to do by the Queen. And I think that that's, again, something we kind of tend to forget, is that she was a servant to the Queen. And she was probably just doing what she was told. So it's, and we sort of tend to forget that, I think.
Yeah, I get the question. I get the question all the time. Did John really think that the reign of Queen Jane would work, or some variation of that question? And it's worth remembering that even Lady Mary's allies,
Yeah, the Spanish ambassador said, you've got no hope, right?
no hope, right? You've either got to surrender or flee. Those are your options. Facing the military might of John Dudley and the council, there was no way she was going to take back the throne. Now, it turned out they vastly underestimated her. But no one thought at the time that it was possible. We have the benefit, or perhaps the disadvantage of hindsight, that we know that she was able to take back the throne and very quickly and relatively easily. No, that was a complete surprise to everyone living in 1553. And there was nothing really, it was obviously very controversial what Edward did, and legally it was iffy. But he was king. He could do things like that. And especially if Jane had turned out to be pregnant, and given birth to a male heir, right? People would have preferred her to Mary. A lot of people would have preferred her to marry anyway. And so John, I think, is only a villain or a fool with that hindsight.
So obviously Jane Grey's reign is very short-lived. It collapses and John Dudley is captured by Queen Mary's forces. During his imprisonment, so before he's executed, he converts back to the Catholic faith, which we're told Jane Grey, his daughter-in-law, is furious about. Do you think that this was just pure lip service to Queen Mary in the hope that it might spare his life?
It's important to remember that this conversion takes place on the day that John was scheduled to be executed, and he's executed the next day. So I think it makes it very difficult to see it as an attempt to save his own life, because it is right before his execution. It's on the day he's meant to have originally to have been executed. It is absolutely lip service to the Queen. He gives a scaffold speech that says all sorts of things about, the error of his ways and the true religion of Catholicism and all of that. And Mary has it printed and distributed, which is very, very clever. And so it's a brilliant PR swoop for Mary. And John participates willingly. It's just really, really hard to imagine he thought that it would save his own skin. We have to remember that all of his sons are imprisoned in the Tower. And also, are they accused of treason at this point? Convicted? I think they've already been convicted. In any case, the axe is hanging over them. I think he does it for them.
Yeah.
And I think that's the deal. Which completely, I think, if we buy that, and I think there's all sorts of reasons we should, completely changes how we understand that conversion. Because John did believe in the Reformed faith. He as Lord President of the King's Council, he participated, he led much of Edward's Reformation. And so for him to so publicly, his last act, right, on the earth, to publicly renounce that faith in favor of Catholicism, the embarrassment of that as well, and to do it in the service of the Queen who is killing him, to do that though in the hopes of saving his sons is actually tragically admirable.
So, very sadly, John Dudley is not the only member of the Dudley family who is executed. His son, Guildford, it follows in his father's footsteps a few months later. Now, obviously, Guildford's involvement in all of this is via his marriage to Lady Jane Grey. When Queen Mary takes over, and she makes it very clear that she has no intention to go through the execution of Jane and Guildford, and that they will eventually be pardoned. When White's rebellion breaks out and Mary feels like her hand is forced into authorizing Jane's execution, why does she also go through with Guildford's execution? Because ultimately, Jane has royal blood. Jane was the person put on the throne. What do you think it was that Mary decided she had to also execute Guildford in the end?
It's a great question. I think it reinforces the suggestion that I certainly try to make, which is that Guildford should be acknowledged as a royal consort, in the line of royal consorts in history, that he was seen as a ruler, even if only for a brief time, but he was acknowledged by the council, foreign ambassadors acknowledged him as King of England. And I think it's that means that he has to go as well. He had been convicted of treason months earlier alongside his brothers. And Mary had been fairly merciful in not doing away with all of them to begin with. But the Wyatt's Rebellion was calling for both of them to be reinstated as monarchs. And if she had allowed Guilford to live, he just would have become another sort of rallying point figurehead for resistance, because he had been King of England.
I totally agree with you about his position that he should be acknowledged as a consort. In fact, so I'm now in the process of writing my second book, and my second book is about the history of the royal consort, and I'm going from Edith of Wessex right through to Philip of Spain and telling the story of each in order, and Guildford has a chapter.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. There was a book not that long ago. I sort of edited a collection on consorts, and I said, "Oh, I'll write the Guildford chapter." And they said, "Well, there isn't going to be a Guildford chapter." And I went, "What?"
He's getting a chapter just the same as everybody else's. Absolutely.
Gosh, I'm pleased to hear it. Thank you. Justice for Guildford.
Justice for Guildford. Yeah, bless him. I mean, I also wasn't it Guildford Dudley's execution where the men, the some of the people that gathered to meet him were shaking his hands and sort of there was real sadness about when he went to his death, I seem to recall.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely the case. I mean, he was still fairly young. He was, we think, about 17. He has been King of England, and I think he was generally well liked. I mean, again, I think fiction drama tends to present him as this weird sort of whiny brat running around Queen Jane. We don't know that much about him, but he would have been well educated. He would have been part of the court even as a young man. And there was every reason for people to admire him at the time. And like Jane, he was seen as a victim of a Catholic regime by those who still held reformist beliefs.
So you mentioned a moment ago about the fact that all of the Dudley boys are imprisoned in the Tower of London. So what became of those other brothers during the reign of Queen Mary? So we have Robert Dudley, but obviously there's also Ambrose. So what happened throughout the rest of Mary's reign?
There are five brothers imprisoned. John is the eldest, named for his father. He dies not that long after Guildford. He falls ill in the Tower in October of the same year in which Guildford is killed, and dies 3 days later. He's released to die in his sister's home. And that leaves three of them. Ambrose becomes the eldest at that point. And then there's Robert, and then a younger brother, Henry. It's, again, here we go, largely thanks to the work of their mother, that they are released. She and her daughters and daughters-in-law essentially take to the court, start making allies, especially amongst the new Spanish court brought over by Philip II. Philip II is wildly unpopular, as Wyatt's Rebellion will attest. As well as all the Spaniards he brings with him. One reports that there's hardly a day goes by without a bit of knife work between the Spanish and the English in the court. So Philip needs English noble allies, and the Dudleys can do that. It's suggested, and I think almost certainly the case, that even before he comes over and marries Queen Mary, Henry Sidney, who is married to Mary Dudley Sidney, convinces him that one of the things he should do when he gets over there is free the Dudley men and use them. And this is very much a policy of Jane Dudley. And in her will, she's giving gifts to Spaniards and other allies to help protect her children. And so they're released. Very much thanks to the work that she does and their sisters and wives do. And they're deployed into the court as allies of Philip II. Robert later calls Philip the savior of the Dudley family. He attributes their salvation to Philip II. And they go to war to support Philip in France. Unfortunately, the elder two, Ambrose and Robert, return. So of all those sons born to John and Jane. Only Ambrose and Robert will remain by the time Mary the First dies and Elizabeth the First comes to the throne.
So, I mean, the most famous member of the Dudley family is obviously undoubtedly Robert Dudley. And it's kind of a strange one, isn't it? Because he's almost viewed, he's kind of viewed as a quite like a lovable rogue, I think, in many respects. He's quite a likable character. You know, he's sort of positioned as a bit of a hunk. And this all stems from the fact that he is known to history as the great favourite of Elizabeth the First. So how did they know each other? Have they known each other from childhood and sort of grown up together?
Well, Robert later claims that he'd known Elizabeth since she was seven, and it was to him that she declared that she'd never marry at that age. But he would say that, wouldn't he? And especially when being presented with, oh, well, she's not married to you, has she? And, oh, well, I knew her way back, and she said she'd never marry. They would have encountered each other. Robert's father being as important as he was in the court of Edward VI, they would have seen each other at various court events, but Elizabeth outranked him so phenomenally that to talk about becoming Elizabeth again, the idea that they were hunting together and just hanging out and things like that is deeply unlikely, as well as the idea that they had some sort of romance in the tower, deeply unlikely.
You're bursting bubbles here.
I know, I'm sorry. Fiction is great. Please enjoy your fiction. But I'm here to ruin it. It's unlikely. Certainly in the months before she came to the throne, Robert seems to have been funding her, somewhat ironically out of the lands of his wife, Amy Robsart. And when she comes to the throne, it appears that she's the one who adds his name to the list of people who should be notified and called to her court. William Cecil is not so keen and wants him in France. Instead, she makes a master of the horse, and he's always there. So it's we can't pinpoint a moment, and I don't think we can write this history from childhood between them. That's what existed between Robert's parents, but I don't think we can locate it for Robert and Elizabeth. But certainly on the day of her coronation, we have the image. There's these fantastic drawings of her coronation, and he is right there, riding just behind her, as is Ambrose.
So you mentioned he was her master of horse. Did he perform any other duties for Elizabeth throughout what would turn out to be a very long reign?
Is that an innuendo question? Or is
No, not at all. No, just, what other, obviously he became the Earl of Leicester. But yeah, did he have other genuine jobs that he did for the Queen?
There were various he was tasked with various things. There's a tendency for her not to want him out of her sight. So there's talk, for instance, that he might lead the English army in Le Havre in the 1560s. That goes to Ambrose. Well, I actually think it was always going to be Ambrose, really. He is the more military of the two. But it also very well may have been because Elizabeth didn't want him to go. And so there's this tendency where she's going to assign him something and then kind of pulls him back in. There's this similar thing happens with Mary, Queen of Scots. Of course, there's this talk that he's going to be sent to marry Mary, Queen of Scots, which appears to be just a great joke between Elizabeth and Mary. Mary in particular finds it hilarious, and thinks that wouldn't it be great if both she and Elizabeth could marry a Dudley? Except Elizabeth would surely want Robert, and Ambrose is just not that good looking. So the great shock of the ambassadors listening to her say all this. And then of course we get to the sort of later part of the reign, and he is going to the Netherlands and leading the English army there, which of course is a great disaster. So generally speaking, he kind of just hangs around the court, and commissions a very many portraits of himself. He commissions a portrait on average every 18 months of himself.
Wow.
Well, he's
quite a vain man then.
Yeah. Well, he was genuinely a hunk and thought so.
I know that he also almost bankrupted himself trying to put on entertainments for Elizabeth when she visited.
Yes, he spends an inordinate amount of money on particularly the 1575 Kenilworth celebrations, which are seen as this last great attempt to convince Elizabeth to marry him. So he's very extravagant. When he dies, he leaves his widow very, very much in debt.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the great what-ifs about history, isn't it, I think, with Elizabeth and Robert Dudley. Had she not been who she was and just been simple Elizabeth, do you think they would have married?
Oh, I mean, if we're really going to play out this counterfactual, he probably would have still been married to Amy Robsart, and then we have to decide whether or not she was done away with. I mean, I think what lies at the heart of that question is, was there a real romantic affection between them? And I think
yeah,
that there
was there
was.
love there?
Don't ask me if it was ever consummated or anything else. I don't know. But both of their actions, and particularly in many ways Elizabeth's, demonstrate that feeling. And we only have to look, I think, to the last letter that he sends her right before his death, and that she keeps it and has marked it in her own handwriting, his last letter, and she keeps it by her bedside.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. It's really touching, isn't it? That tells you, I think, a lot about how she felt about him.
Yeah. And that he always bounces back, right? No matter how angry she gets, and she gets really justifiably angry at him, he's always forgiven. He's always brought back. I think the what happens in the Netherlands is a great example of that. You know, he essentially becomes sovereign of the Netherlands without her permission, she's angry about it. And he tries various strategies, throwing people under the bus and so on. And finally, sends someone to ask her permission to send over her physician because he's so ill. And that's what does it. That's she softens, with the thought of well, he might die over there. And that's what allows her to sort of, well, allows him to get back into her good graces and what prompts her to forgive him. There's something there.
Yeah, I definitely think there was something there. I think that the evidence of that last letter in particular, I think, is just that tells you a lot, I think. So the end of your book explores the fascinating and little known story of a woman, Alice Dudley, not born a Dudley, she marries a Dudley, but she goes on to possess the title of Duchess Dudley in her own right. Obviously, women having titles in their own right was incredibly rare then, as it is now. So how and why did this happen to this woman who married a Dudley but ends up becoming a Duchess Dudley in her own right?
Yeah, it's a fascinating one. I barely touch on it, and really it could become a book of its own. When Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, dies, he leaves sort of three Roberts to fight over his inheritance.
They weren't very original, were they, with their names?
Well, you name people in hopes that they'll give you money. And Robert was fairly rich. So one of them is his own illegitimate son, also named Robert Dudley, who is a bit of a scamp. He tries to circumnavigate the globe, doesn't really work. He spends much of his life trying to make an argument for his own legitimacy, probably wasn't. And when that doesn't really go the way he wants, he leaves his wife, Alice, and runs off with his cousin, his much younger than him cousin, to Italy and marries her. And they proceed to have, I think it's like 16 children. In Italy, which is where you get the fantastically named Cosimo Dudley and various other iterations. And from Italy, he continues to try to make the argument for his own legitimacy. I think it's a Holy Roman Emperor, or somebody names him Duke of Northumberland, but from outside of England, so he's not really Duke of Northumberland. Somebody just gives him that title. Meanwhile, the English Civil War is going on, it gets very caught up in the politics of all of that. But essentially, he dies in Italy, and it's at the Restoration that Alice gets this title of Duchess Studley, because she's faithful. She remains. She's loyal. And she doesn't have any children, so there's no concern about the title continuing. It's just this fantastic reward she gets for persevering. And I ended the book with that, in some way, in recognition of the role that the women had played in the Dudley family throughout its history. There's
a real full circle sort of moment.
Yeah. Alice is rewarded with Duchess Dudley in the way that I think all the women of the Dudley family should have been in some way. And so, yeah, it's a fascinating, scandalous little story. And I just think she's really interesting, Duchess Dudley.
And she was given this title personally by Charles I, right?
Yeah, it's an attempt from Charles I to try to shore up allies right before he's killed. So, yes.
Well, final question then. What do you think is the Dudleys' great legacy that they left behind? You know, this is a family that had execution following them, but is that their legacy? What would you say is their true legacy?
I think to many people's minds, that has become their legacy. And as I said, that's what interested me first in them. But I think in many ways, the legacy of the Dudley family is the legacy of the Tudor period. Every Tudor monarch had a relationship with the Dudley, either crushing them for their own gain or raising them up and ruling in a sense beside them. We get so much of what we associate with the Tudor period from the Dudleys, the fact that there is a Tudor dynasty at all, that's built on that first peaceful transition of power from Henry VII to Henry VIII. And that's only made possible with the work, the morally dubious work of Edmund Dudley. I talked about the Navy, the patronage of art. I mean, Shakespeare is thrown in there. He has all sorts of associations with the Dudleys through Warwickshire as well. We've talked about the Reformation. We've talked about the fact that Elizabeth doesn't marry, in some part at least, because she can't marry the one man she may have wanted to, Robert. So much of what we associate with the Tudor period really comes from this intertwining of these two houses, Tudor and Dudley. And so I'd like to hope, at least, that through the work that I've done on this family and through this book, we start to see them as an integral part of the Tudor period.
Which I absolutely think is the case. I think, like you say, it's the fact that they saw it all in one way or another. And that's pretty astonishing, really. So, yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. That was a great discussion. I think people are going to be really, really interested to hear what you've had to say. And thank you again.
Thank you. It's always fun to chat about the Dudleys.
And so that brings us to the end of this week's episode of the Tudor Chess Podcast. My thanks to the amazing Dr. Joanne Paul for joining the show and sharing the stories of the Dudley family with us. Joanne's book, The House of Dudley, from which we base the conversation around today, is available via all usual book outlets, Amazon, Waterstones, etc. A reminder again that I also release a weekly bonus subscriber episode, which can be accessed via Patreon or Apple Podcasts. Thank you again for your support of the Tudor Chest, and speak soon.